we talked to others before in view of the fact that they were leaving earlier, coming from other committees. So I would ask the department, the minister and the department, to respond briefly at this point and then take the next three, Honourable Shin and Brissini and Frayling and two others after that. So we're...
My question is somehow related to this, so I'm wondering whether it would not be more efficient to take them.
It's probably on an energy front, yes. But, you know, and I hate saying no to you, Honourable Ambrosini, because I know your questions are really, really are important. But I see others also wanting to come in at this point. So what I'd like to do is to... you know, endorse the unless it's directly related to the point made by your predecessor. Thanks. Okay.
Okay. Let me start, and then I'll hand over to Nimrod. The first one I'm going to take is the one from Elizabeth Tabetti, and just to say that I think she's hit a very, very important issue, and that is the coordination that's required across departments. It was something I said earlier on. It's why I think it's important that at the parliamentary level you come together and oversee, because if you look at the detailed narrative, you will see that there are lead departments identified, they're not always the DTI, and then there are all sorts of other supporting departments and agencies that are required to come in. And indeed, I think that when you saw at the beginning, we didn't call this the EPAP of the DTI, we called it the EPAP of the Economic Sectors and Employment Cluster. It's the program of the cluster. It's not the only program of the cluster, it's one of the programs of the cluster. But this is a matter which we're going to have to confront, and I think the appointment of the Economic Development Department is one of the roles it needs to play this role of running around and coordinating. Because one of the difficulties that we have had before is that we're all peers, and I think I don't want to give any examples, but it is the case that there are things that have been repeated here from the previous IPAP, and things that we said we were going to do there, some of the things that have not been done there are not in the domain of the DTI. I think that's a reality that we're going to have to cope with, and so that's part of it. But I think the mechanism that's going to drive us is this monitoring and evaluation. We're going to be held not just to activity reporting, but we're going to be held to outcome targeting as well. And I think that the whole cluster is going to be bound by that. So there are a number of mechanisms in place to do that, but I do think that that is one of the major issues. And just to respond to the Honourable Krulock, he says there's a lot of stuff here, and yes, I think it's correct. And the reason there's a lot of stuff is, as I said earlier on, because we have a fairly diversified industrial sector, and I think we can't just do one or two things and leave everything else out. But if we want to say, what are the big ideas that are coming out here? What are the big ideas, maybe? I think the big ideas that are coming out here is, I would say there's two of them. And that is that we have an infrastructure investment program in this country, which is very fundamental to move our economy forward and was the most important counter-cyclical measure that we had in place, that we continue to run the infrastructure program. That's what we need to keep going. Well, what we need to do from that infrastructure investment program is to make sure that we generate local industrial development off it. There have been a number of things that have been proposed. The competitive supplier development program was based on the idea that it's in the interest of the procurer to stimulate local production. Yes, it is, but that idea itself has not generated the results that we need. And we've had these other measures in place, like the National Industrial Participation Program, which says if you import anything worth $10 million or more, you've got to have an offset program. Number of problems with that. This thing was first of all, you negotiated the offset after you awarded the contract, you lost the leverage. Secondly, it could be in any other area, not necessarily in the area where you're procuring. Thirdly, not clear that it applied in other spheres of government, particularly local government. We're going to have to bring those all together into a comprehensive set of arrangements for procurement. In the meantime, we're going to say, let's take 8 or 10 products, bite-sized things, put it into this fleet program. I think let's just see what this word fleet is apparently something which I learned as well in the course of doing this work. It's something that has currency in procurement. It means multiple stages, and it means basically that we have phase one, phase two, phase three. If in phase one we want to buy buses, we say we haven't got the buses in South Africa, the same people that get the contract in phase one by phase two will be expected to manufacture a certain proportion in South Africa, and by phase three a higher proportion. That's the kind of thing that we can do. If you're not prepared to play ball, you don't get the contract. Somebody else gets the contract. Those are the sort of things that we can do. And I think one of the big ideas is that we want to start to grapple with this procurement thing. So there's a new approach to actually getting the industrial development opportunities off that. The second big idea, I think, is to tackle this development financing. Yes, it's true, as Mr. Maria says, it's not talking about all development financing, but development financing for industrial development. All the successful countries that have industrialized, developing countries industrialized, have had something like this that operates on a larger scale to ours. So I think this is what we say. So in the longer term, a regular inflow of funding into the IDC. In the immediate term, let's look at its balance sheet and see what more they can do. We already did begin to do some of that work with the crisis response. But it's absolutely fundamental, I think, if we want to get these sectors going. Then, on Mr. Maria's point, where are the jobs going to come from? We are not saying that all the jobs are going to come from the value-added sectors. We are not saying that. In fact, I think many of the jobs will come from the service sectors, as they have done before. But there's a world of difference, I believe, between a set of service sectors that are relating to and building on a growing production sector and service sectors which are relying on consumption-driven, credit-driven growth. That, there's a world of difference. And I think, in fact, I would want to argue, there's been no case anywhere in economic history. You can go back to the Principality of Venice, where a country has set out on a path of increasing returns, growing decent employment, without this being led by a series of value-added sectors which are targeted, chosen, and supported. And in our case, I think that what we're saying is the next big wave of industrial development that we can foresee in this country coming from two things. One, from producing inputs into the areas where we're supplying inputs into the infrastructure program. A range of engineering industries of different sorts where we have actually had some capacity in the past. We've probably lost it quite a bit. We can regain that, develop it in new directions. It can then be used to extend into similar projects on the African continent and even further afield. That's a new capability we can move into. And then the other one is this green energy. We've got to, for our own reasons for energy saving and also the common global commitment to address climate change, we've got to go green. But what people are saying around the world is that it's not just an obligation, there are also opportunities. So we're trying to identify a few opportunities. Some quick wins, but right across every sector we want to push into greener direction. And then the other one where there are quick wins in employment is agro-industry. So we're putting those three up there. But we can't neglect the rest. And even in all the rest, you'll see there's quite different architectures. Like Nimrod mentioned it in the clothing and textiles. There are different incentive schemes. Our analysis tells us the biggest problem with clothing and textiles is actually that people don't invest and raise productivity. If they do that, there are niches we can go for. And in fact, our research is telling us we can grow employment. Well, why don't we do it? We change the incentive scheme. And we're not looking to... yes, at some point I think we do have to come in and we're going to have to present how is all this costed in relation to the budget. But the main thrust of industrial financing that we're talking about now is not on budget, it's off budget. We actually have for most of the schemes we need on budget. We've more or less covered from the requests we made. We're more or less covered in the budget that was announced last week. More or less covered there. So, as we move ahead, it says so. Maybe that we need some more on-budget incentive programs. Not we're going to hand out people a bunch of money for rent-seeking. One of the tricks in industrial policy is also knowing when to withdraw support. If it's not working, we've got to withdraw. But I think at the moment we're saying we've got a range of areas where if we did provide some support of the right kind, we think we can make some headway. Yes. This is not the SMME program. This is not the the co-op program and things like that. I have said on a number of occasions in the department that is the second area of important work that we need to address this year, is to boost those programs. We think SMMEs will benefit from the fact that we will be growing our economy, including in some of these sectors, and not all of those sectors are going to be only big firms. Many engineering activities allow for small firms. The BEE, if we get the BEE right, we can create a symbiotic relationship between big and small companies around actual productive activity. I think we can create those opportunities, but we also do need to boost the other programs around SMMEs. And then finally, I would just say on the spatial industrial development. I think that's an area of work where we need to put much more effort. And in fact, it's probably something which is more likely to fall in the court of economic development. But we have begun this discussion. We have the IDZ, which have tried to promote industrial decentralization. We have something else called the special economic zone. IDZs are very much linked to export industries, the whole way the infrastructure and also the incentives, very much linked to export industries. I don't think that it's the case that they've all been total failures. I think that some of the models that were around, that you needed a big anchor tenant that was going to be a smelter, well, that clearly hasn't worked. But I think that, for example, Kucha has actually managed to reposition itself, and it has attracted a number of investments there. So I think there are some successes there as well. But whether, extension of IDZs across the country and all sorts of places, is that the way forward, or are there other instruments and ways of promoting industrial decentralization? I think that's a piece of work that we need to move ahead with more rapidly, and it becomes more pressing as, in fact, we move into a higher level of industrial policy. So those are the kind of answers I give. I think there's several other questions that I haven't answered that Nimrod wants to take those.
Thank you. Let me start off with the questions related to minerals and beneficiation. Let me start off with the beneficiation level and what's said about beneficiation in the document. I think what's reflected in the beneficiation section, downstream beneficiation section, I think really we've been largely dependent on input from Department of Mineral Resources in this regard. But I think and obviously there has been this outstanding matter of identifying these minimum beneficiation levels. I think we would certainly agree that this is by no means enough, or the entirety of our response to downstream beneficiation. However, I mean, it's very, very important that this gets concluded because, for amongst other reasons, it's a necessary piece of work in order for mining companies to deploy the part of the legislation that allows them to go for beneficiation offsets. And thus far, I think they haven't been able to engage or facilitate beneficiation because these levels haven't been set. So I think that's the one element that's quite important. Then the second issue on procurement, we haven't tried to quantify how much mining investment we anticipate and mining procurement and we anticipate, but clearly from the figures you've indicated, it's quite substantial. And I think the broader point is that perhaps there needs to be a similar exercise in the mining sector to encourage miners to procure as much as possible and to raise the competitiveness and localization of their supply chain in South Africa. And we've seen that work very successfully, for instance, in the case of the Petrobras in Brazil, where one of the reasons why they are such a competitive oil and gas exploration and extraction company is because they've developed very sophisticated abilities to do very deep sea oil drilling, and that has come partly through their proactive development of their capital equipment supply base. So mining capital equipment is one of the areas that we certainly identify as an opportunity. Then on the financing side, I think financing is it's a very important element, both with respect to further beneficiation, but also, with, as you say, I think we need to pick up the point on small-scale miners. But to give you one example, I mean, one of the key areas where beneficiation is possible is precisely in relation to the capital expenditure program. It's the metal fabrication and machinery products that feed into the CapEx program. And one of the challenges, the financing challenges that local companies face is that they are up against very concessional export financing from importers who are financed by their own export credit banks or agencies at very, very low interest rates, and sometimes, you know, interest rates that are close to zero. So the financing issue is very important. Then I think on the coordination issues, I think the Minister has largely canvassed it, but I think also to say that, you know, that I think there are a number of mechanisms that can assist with coordination. The first is the cluster itself within government. The second is that part of the approval of the IPAP has been an instruction from Cabinet that every 6 months we go back and we report on progress. And I think that actually allows us an opportunity to use that requirement to go back and say, you know, these are where the bottlenecks are. You know, these are some of the things that need to be done. And then, of course, the role of Parliament and committees and chairs who are present here will be absolutely essential in overseeing this and making sure that every department plays its role in implementing. Then there were some issues raised about skills and skills development, which we also agree with. And I think one of the areas of emphasis of the IPAP is that we want the sectors and the sector strategies and the sector work to play much more of a role of feeding into the skills development system. The skills needs, particularly the critical skills needs, and there are a couple of examples where this has already started to happen. One is in the business process services sector. There's a Monietla program, a program called Monietla, which is a dedicated training program for call centres, which came precisely out of these self-discovery exercises. There's a similar a kind of thing coming that, on stream, that's going to be part of the clothing and textile program, which is part of these discussions, identifying at a very detailed level what are the skills gaps in the clothing and textiles and footwear leather industry, and what should the associated CETA focus on, and asking the National Skills Fund for additional funding in order to fill in some of the funding gaps. Then I think some of the financing questions have been answered, but I think the finalization of this mechanism to provide further financing to the IDC. I mean, it's set out very clearly in the document, you know, by the end of Q2 of the new financial year, this needs to be completed. This is a matter that needs to be agreed between departments like Economic Development, National Treasury, and DTI. And again, I think the oversight role of Parliament would be very important in this regard, in making sure that, you know, that this is expedited. Then, but having said that, there's a significant chunk of odd budget financing that departments have, including DTI, but also other departments. And of course, we're saying again in the first quarter of the year that the IDC must go through its own balance sheet and start to identify areas where it can start reprioritizing even before this external financing mechanism kicks in. Then I think the role of the point on SMEs is also taken, and perhaps the document is not explicit enough in this regard, because I think there's quite a strong shift in the document to say that, you know, our emphasis is no longer on these big capital intensive, energy intensive, mega projects. It's really on trying to unlock the more small and medium and small opportunities in a whole range of sectors. So in the fabrication, metal fabrication, capital equipment sector, yes, it will, you know, it involves large construction companies, but supplying into those companies are the medium and small fabricators. In automotive, it's saying there's a shift from, you know, just the focus on the large assemblers. The real job creation and the real value add is going to come in the componentry part of the sector. So you know, similarly chemicals, plastics, pharmaceuticals, we're saying the shift must be relatively towards the more value-added and labor-intensive plastics fabrication, you know, pharmaceuticals types of activities. We've got the large, you know, the large petrochemicals investments in place already. I think that covers, hopefully covers the point. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Just to keep everyone on board, we are going to be having tea just now, but we are going to take the next four questions, and then they will be responded to after tea. We'll also enable Mr. Zulk to water his throat. Got the Honourable Shin, Ambrosini, Kraling, and Kotze. I will be taking the Honourable Hadjadj, yes, the Honourable Khadebe. I thought earlier your hand was up, Honourable Kamalu, but it shifted, yes, right. So if we can have these questions now, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's a very comprehensive, very ambitious, and a very time-tight program that you've just spoken to us about. A couple of things that just concern me. You have a bit of a downer on the consumer-driven economy. Without consumers, there's no point in producing stuff. So, you know, I can understand your concern that it's been, you know, we've been spending beyond our means and too much credit, but I want to have some kind of assurance that we're not going to be producing goodies that are going to be sitting in workshops, in warehouses. I mean, that there is a sound business case for everything that is in your plan, that we actually don't invest money just because it's a good idea. Also, your example, perhaps, of how to leverage extra funding for the IDC, perhaps using the funds of the Workers' Compensation Fund, which, as far as I understand, is perhaps a very high-risk idea at this stage, and perhaps there should be some other ideas there. And then also your job numbers startle me. Can you sort of say how many of these jobs are actually private industry jobs, and how many of them are likely to be state infrastructure jobs? How many of these will be public service? Because I'd hate to think that we're actually bloating the public service in support of this very ambitious program. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Three and a half points, if I may. The first point is that I've got another 1,000 points to make. And I say that seriously. This document needs to be interrogated. It's not the place, it's not the time for those points to be made. But I wish to share in the sentiments expressed by the Honourable Turok and the Honourable Marais that this is perhaps, my humble opinion, the most important document before Parliament, and it is one which requires the undivided attention of any one of you that can contribute. And I would dare to say an attention provided, a contribution made, irrespective of party lines, irrespective of political agendas, because this is the, there's been lots of talk about industrial policy. There is a tangential point of no return. We are getting there. So we need to do it and do it now. And so the first point is that I plead that sufficient attention be given in Parliament, prioritize over conflicting items that we have on our agenda. The second point, Madam Chairman, is that I struggle a little bit to tease out the real philosophy of this document. I accept the premises. I think the premises and the identification of problems, the setting of goals, is something that I personally cannot take exception to. But when it comes to the methodology, it seems, in my humble opinion, perhaps in my misreading, that it escapes the fundamental aspect that this must be about making the money. It's about the money. So there are, and the issue to me is to differentiate between what makes money and what costs money. Example, we can't make a locomotive engine for this country alone. Just doesn't work that way. Locomotive engines is a type of goods which are made for the global market. Now, if we create conditions to make a locomotive engine here, which can be done, we may end up in a situation in which we create again a regime of subsidies, import restrictions, etc., etc., where the engine is going to be more expensive here and is going to be exported more cheaply to our foreign buyers, as it happens for the auto vehicles produced here, which are twice the price of what they cost in world terms, and the same vehicle is acquired more cheaply abroad, even though it's manufactured here. That's not the type of thing that makes money, that costs money. And the same thing with beneficiation. I mean, if import beneficiation means to get something into the marketplace only for local consumption, which costs more than what would otherwise, then all we're doing, we're not making money, we're just imposing a much higher indirect burden on effectively the middle class, which is the only one which, which is the one which is bearing the major, proportionally the major burden through the indirect and indirect fiscal system. And that doesn't take the country to the other side. We need to look at what can make money globally, and I agree with the Honorable Turk. It is a matter of adding value, but in a way which is competitive in global markets, and profitable, and yes, suits cost at times 5 rands, they cost 10 rands in global terms, I mean 50 rands, that happens, and yes, we cannot compete with that type of manufacturing. Yes, factories today are global factories, whether are the global factories for cell phone in Sweden or those make global, those who make suits for global, for the global markets in China. So we need to be very careful on the philosophy and focusing on the making of money and not exclusively on keeping things happening and on the output. If we focus on the output of the on the turnover, the output of the production system, we will make, which could be an intermediate stage, but at the end there must be the money. Then the third point that I wanted to make is this must be the triumph of the will, of the political will. The points made in this plan are not new, they've been made many, many times. Identification of problems which we can fix, lack of flexibility in the labor market, high tariff rates, high cost of banking, high cost of communication, high cost of ports, inefficiency. I mean, we have heard these things at least since 1998. Unless there is an iron will behind to just go down on the axe and step on the feet and crash the heads of those that get in the head, figuratively speaking, and then we are going to have the same discussion next year and the following year. So the must be the triumph of the political will over the bureaucratic trade union will not, or whatever else gets in the way, and plead for that. And that vision, I think it's important. The fourth element is one of vision. Let's identify industries which do not exist yet. And let's create them with government becoming the nursery of that. And in that respect, I'm quite surprised that there is nothing about tourism seen as an industry, because it's obviously one of the major money makers in South Africa as an industry. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have the Honourable
Achleben. Thank you, Chair. I agree with Honourable Ambassini. I think this is an extremely important document and one we've waited a long time for, and I think it's something that we can all definitely engage with and certainly run with. I mean, I think one of the points that have been raised a number of times here is one of coordination and the fact that this falls into other different departments. And if I can be as cheeky as to suggest, what would actually be of help, and I sit in a number of these committees actually, is to almost try and flesh out the different action plans for each of these committees so that we can then have a program of action with which to then provide oversight over these departments, so we can start to actually really question these departments to make sure that these things are happening in each of these different departments. I think that could certainly be helpful. One of the things that I've been looking at here, I mean, obviously the infrastructure build program is hugely influential within this industrial action plan. And I'm just wondering whether you've looked at the infrastructure build program as it currently is in terms of the current plans of departments and have simply looked at how to use then leverage procurement over that? Or have you started to interrogate some of these plans to say that, in fact, if we do this differently, if we choose different technologies, if we choose different ways of, in fact, providing this infrastructure, we can create more jobs? Is that a process that the department has undertaken? Because I think that that could certainly be helpful as well. One of the other things that I've seen is that it's also about getting the institutions right. I mean, that seems to have been the experience around the world as well, is that you've got to have the right institutions driving the right things. And for instance, if I look at, I mean, you've mentioned green jobs, and I'm very impressed that you've mentioned that as a priority. But I mean, if I look at our experience in green jobs so far, it's been very poor. And one of the reasons for that is, for instance, the solar water heater program has rested with Eskom. And clearly we haven't achieved our objectives there. So I'm just wondering whether you're going to leave that up to individual departments to start to question where these things lie and where they need to be removed and where they need to coordinate better, or is that something that you're looking at as well? The other thing, though, that I was also looking at is that I think we almost need a kind of rapid response unit, because one blockage can hold the whole thing up. Like, for instance, with the solar water heater program, SABS not approving solar water heaters, or taking a long time to approve solar water heaters, holds the whole chain up all the way down and holds back job creation in terms of that. So in a sense, we've got to be able to identify these things quickly, get in there and make sure that those problems are sorted out. And I think that Parliament can certainly help in that particular way as well. Obviously, I've got a lot more points, but I will bring that up as the discussions go on.
Thank you for being brief, Honourable Crayling. Much appreciated. Honourable Cotsey.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I would also want to perhaps raise some issues in terms of what the Minister and perhaps the input that was given. I think it would be important perhaps for us to know at least on each sector what is the target of jobs that need to be created. We see the round figure, but if perhaps each sector we could understand what is the target. In this case, I want to zoom in into the clothing and textile industry. There's strong belief that there is no way that we can ever compete with countries like China and India in terms of that. Therefore, us as a country, where do we need to concentrate in terms of clothing? Because already people have lots of jobs. How do we reverse that? Are we looking at tapping into Africa, for instance? Because if we talk as well, export, we talk about Western countries, but what are we doing? We're part of NEPAD in South Africa. What are we doing in terms of looking into our own continent around that, rather than competing with those countries because of obvious reasons? There's no way that we could compete with them. Again, an issue of the high labor costs in South Africa, and also very low production. The minister perhaps did not talk about that because it involves perhaps the trade unions and so on, because if indeed we want to achieve most of these targets, there is no way that we can leave out that sector as in terms of what stands now in terms of how we produce as a country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Hajjaj.
Just two quick points. First of all, I think the excellent document, something we've been waiting for quite some time. However, I have a concern, is, and I think some of the other members also talked about that, is the fact that I know that this thing has to work under the cluster system of ministers and ministries and departments, because there's such a lot of overlap and cross-cutting issues. But how, I mean, speaking from what we've experienced in the past, Mr. Minister, despite the fact that we have now a minister who's going to oversee and monitor, how are these departments actually going to decide what each one has to do in terms of this program and the budget for what it has to do, and how they're going to bring all of these issues together to make the whole this industrial action plan work. That's the one thing. The other issue is that my sister over there just talked about. In this action plan, have we looked, I know that our first priority at this point in time is South Africa, but we do have commitments to the NEPA program of action in Africa. And we have always said that our development must go hand in hand with Africa's development. Have we looked at how this can actually assist the development of Africa? Because we are looking at them as a major trading partner, and unless we can actually assist them with their own development, I don't exactly see how well we will be able to trade with Africa. So just those two questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And just the closing round of this question, the 14, Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. I think I'll echo the sentiments of the people who spoke before me, that this is a necessary plan. The economy of the country needs such a plan. And then what is also important is that it also tinkers on the issue of the structural change of the economy. But the question which I'd like to ask here is related to what Meko has asked before, is that in order for such a plan to work, you need the buy-in of the stakeholders. The question I'd like to ask is that did the industry, the trade unions, and the broader society buy into this plan? Because if they didn't buy in, we can have a situation whereby others will be pulling in the other direction, others pulling in the other direction. And then I'm asking that question because we have public hearings next week. The people will be coming. I'd like to hear it from the department itself. Number two, I see that you spoke about the issue of the strength of the currency, which obviously affects the growth of this economy or in the implementation of the plan itself. But I think at the state we are in now, we said our manufacturing has been lowered by 18%. It means that if our manufacturing is lower, it means that it's got listings to export. So basically, it means that we are actually importing than exporting. So is it not better to have a stronger currency when you're importing so that you can buy things cheaper? Because if you relax the currency itself, it means that whatever technology you're going to get from outside, you're going to spend more from that. I'll ask those two questions and then reserve the others for the public hearing. Thank you, Chief.
Right. What we're going to do now is allow just a very short tea break. I'd really encourage you to bring your cups of tea back if you can't finish them within 10 minutes. It's just on my watch, 10 past. If we can be back before 20 past, that would be helpful.
Okay.
and then the DG will take some, and then Nomad will take some others. Let me just start by saying that I want to strongly welcome and support the point that's been made by a number of members, Professor Turok, Mr. Moret, Mr. Ambrosini, Mr. Freiling, Mr. Khadebi, about the importance of prioritizing this piece of work. I think I want to support that and hope that the committee can really do a quality, the committees can really do a quality job on overseeing the implementation of this. In respect of the points made by Member Shin, I don't think that we are saying that we should be producing things or can be producing things without there being some consumption of these goods. But I think what we're saying is that there's been a major imbalance in our economy, that consumption-led sectors have grown fast and production-led sectors have grown much more modestly. And that then creates a whole series of imbalances. I think that's what we're basically pointing out. So we're not saying that when we correct that, we want to correct this by producing a whole lot of things that people can't use and so on. I mean, that's not it at all. Then we must just, I think, be a little bit clear about what is the FAT in Brazil, the Fundo Assistencia Trabalhadores. It's not the unemployment insurance fund that you pay to the workers. It's another contribution collected from employers and so on, which is basically to support job creation. That's what it is. And I don't think, as Nimrod Dark said, we're not saying that that's the model for South Africa or anything like that. I think the only point we're making is that there's a regular funding stream that is coming in to the balance sheet of the BMDS. That's the only point that we're making there. And then I think most of those jobs will actually come from the private sector, actually, most of the jobs. Then on to some of the points made by Member Ambrosini. He wants to know what is the real philosophy that underlies this. Is it about making money or trusting money, that sort of a thing? Well, I think you know, at the end of the day, what we're looking at is we're looking to create competitive industries that are on a sustainable basis are going to be able to create decent work in this country. That's what it's about. But I think that what we often find, and this is the case of developing countries, is that the establishment costs and the development costs of what become competitive industries is often too high for private institutions to go into. That has been, I would argue, that's been the experience of many of the so-called Asian tigers in countries like that. I mean, there were people who were sitting around in Korea and were objecting like mad to the establishment of a shipbuilding industry in Korea. And lo and behold, Korea is now one of the world's leading shipbuilding countries. So I think that what you have is a situation where you probably need to socialize some of those establishment and development costs and address some of the constraints in order to create the conditions for those kinds of industries to emerge. And I think that's what it's about. So we need a purposeful set of policy-driven actions that are going to create the conditions for industries to emerge. I think that's the kind of philosophy. Having said that, I would want to say that I think he is quite right about this having to be driven by political will. That is what it's about. What we have got here is we've got a document which has gone to the cabinet, represents the collective position of the cabinet, represents the more directly the collective position of the cluster, the economic cluster. And in terms of I want to support the idea that Mr. Craig put forward, that each committee takes out the particular responsibilities of their own department to monitor those. I think that's quite a good idea. Because it does depend, and he's quite right about that you can have one blockage holds the whole thing up. I don't want to be specific, and I'm not going to get drawn on this, but there's one program which we announced almost exactly the same in the previous IPAP, and it has been held up on a particular regulatory reform which was supposed to drive the thing through, and we are promising exactly the same because of exactly what you've been talking about. So I think that is what we do need. And some of this will happen at the level of the government, through some of the reforms that we've been putting in place. I think something like the role of the Economic Development Department is going to be very critical. The monitoring and evaluations I mentioned earlier on, but parliamentary oversight, I think, can play a very, very significant role in that regard. The questions raised by Honourable Member Kotze, actually, if you look at the slides even, you'll see that there's a breakdown by sector of the jobs, the appendix, and it's also contained in the document itself. On the clothing and textiles, we're not trying to compete with mass-based clothing products from China, etc., etc. We're not trying to situate ourselves there. Our analysis is telling us that there are specific niches that we can target, and one of them, which you mentioned a couple of times, is fast fashion. What does this mean? It means that it takes a month for something to be ordered and come from overseas to come into South Africa. It takes about a month. And there's an opportunity for manufacturers, some of whom are doing it. If you walk around this town and you go to clothing factories, like I've been on a number of occasions, you'll find that some of the better ones are doing exactly that. They have designs which they negotiate with the retailers, and they respond quickly to demand, seasonal demand, fashion changes and things like that. It's called fast fashion. And there is a real opportunity for that in this country, as there is in sportswear, I said, camping equipment, that sort of stuff. And what our research is telling us, just to repeat, is that the biggest problem in the clothing textile industry is investment in productivity increases. That's what it's about. That's the biggest problem. We sometimes get this thing called sweating the assets. You run the factory until the machines break down and you fire all the workers. They're not reinvesting. So our program now is trying to address exactly that. So you're not going to get a duty credit which you can, as people say, spend on your holiday home in Plettenberg Bay. You're going to get a support measure which you can use and redeem against an approved investment or a productivity-related improvement. And our research is telling us that we can stabilize employment. Nearly 100,000 people currently employed in that industry have been losing, 200,000 once, but they say we can grow employment. So I think that's an important thing for us to do. Do we have high labor costs and low productivity? I think that was the other point you made. I would say certainly we have higher labor costs than some of the other countries, the very low wage countries in the world. We have higher labor costs. Do we have lower productivity? Not necessarily. There are a number of South African branches of companies, even the auto industry, which win awards, company awards for productivity and things like that. I think some of you go to some of the better OEMs in the motor industry, they'll tell you that what we do in South Africa is as good as things that happen in Germany and so on. Clearly what this means is it means that we have to identify particular niches, that we have to go for niches, because I don't think that even if we were to choose to say that we're not going to protect any workers, we're going to let the wages go to the bottom, we're going to engage in the race for the bottom, I don't believe we'd be successful anyway if we did that. And it's not anything we want to contemplate. So I think we have to go for particular niches. Quickly on what Honourable Hajaj said, she's asking us about the region and so on, and talking about NEPAD. Well, there's one other thing as well, which is quite important, which I should mention, and that is that at the moment we are the chair of something called the Council of African Ministers of Industry, which is supposed to be promoting industrial policy and industrial development across the African continent. And I think that what is clearly very, very important is that we need to start promoting much more energetic conversations and cooperation around industrial policy issues. I mean, we are finding, I think, in our region that this is becoming a very, very high imperative. What is the sort of way in which a country like Lesotho might industrialize or develop industrial sectors based on its proximity to South Africa? And I think there's a number of lessons there, some of them not particularly positive, but I want to give you one positive one. There is an investment in a compact fluorescent light bulb factory in Lesotho. which is taking place. It's a Philips project. It's being supported by UNCTAD, United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. Now, that project is only feasible because we have a customs union, because they need a tariff for a period of time to apply, not in Lesotho, but in South Africa as well. They also need, in the longer term, they want to get into the SADC market, so the FTA with free trade area with SADC is very important for that as well. And I think those are examples. And we are going, Nimrod and the team are going to go and engage with SWAPI about identifying value chains and possible ways with a cooperative basis that other neighboring countries could relate to value chains in South Africa as the strongest industrial economy in the region, which could benefit industrial development among themselves. And I think that's a kind of a conversation and a form of cooperation which we really badly need. Apart from which, then the other thing is that if we go the direction of industrial development in input into the infrastructure program, then I think that similar infrastructure programs will be happening elsewhere on the continent. So we'll be developing a capacity to start developing those capabilities, but then also trying to have the same articulation between bigger and smaller companies, between our companies that may go to another country and smaller companies in those countries. I think that's the sort of thing that we're looking at. So I think that in the medium term, longer term, our relationship with the region and the industrial trajectory that we're on and how it relates to the region is a very, very important question. I think it was, Mr. Kraling asked a question about were we looking at the infrastructure build program as it is, or was it being interrogated? Well, within the cluster on infrastructure, there's quite a lot of discussion of that. I mean, we don't directly involve ourselves in that. I suppose we do take, there is this infrastructure, this investment taking place, what are the industrial development opportunities of it. But there is that discussion beginning to happen, and I think it's an important discussion. How could the infrastructure program be rejigged so that it itself generates more employment and more industrial development opportunities off that? The last two questions from the Khaderi. The buying in of stakeholders, industries and unions. Well, first of all, this thing didn't sit in the office and draw it up in a vacuum. Each of the sectors has got something called a customized sector program, which is behind it. And each of those have been consulted with industry and unions in all the different sectors. Then we have engaged NEDLAC on many of these ideas. We've engaged manufacturers at different levels. And I think actually if you see some of the responses that have come out from some of the industry associations and some of the unions, they're generally being quite positive. But I think we'll see. That doesn't mean everybody is going to agree with every comma and every point. Obviously there's an ongoing discussion and dialogue, but I think that broadly speaking, we are more or less moving in the same direction. I think it's important that we do all move in the same direction, and that has required this collective exercise of what we call self-discovery. Is the strength of the currency not a virtue because it makes our imports cheaper? Well, yes, it does make our imports cheaper, but the problem is that we haven't been making enough headway in our exports of value-added products, and we have been importing too many products that we can compete, that we could produce locally. And if you look at one of the tables, I can't remember which one it is, Nimrod has got it there, you look at one of the tables, you'll see what has actually happened to our currency. Now, back. That's right. You see what's happened to the currency. It's gone zooming up in the recent period, and it's become, and many other emerging market currencies that have been going the other way. China, I don't think anybody's remotely suggesting we're going to be able to follow the same sort of policies as China, but China aggressively keeps its currency competitive. It knows it's a fundamental instrument of its industrial development, and I think that just gives you a story. I'm afraid it has gone somewhat in the opposite direction. And I can tell you, actually, I don't want to go into details, but I can tell you people spoke to me yesterday, and what's happened is that the euro has recently weakened, and our currency is not. And people tell me about export orders that we've lost as a result of that. It's an issue.
Minister, I was trying to see if there's any question that you didn't tackle. It looks like you tackled all of the questions. I just thought, and just to think, the comments and the questions that I've had, I think they're useful, particularly the one about casting this in a way that gives a sense of what are the priorities. So we'll take that on board. I thought, in the absence of any of the questions that have been asked for me to answer, I could supplement a question from the earlier session around SMEs. Because, in fact, actually, fundamentally, this is about creating opportunities for SMEs to integrate into supply chains. International comparisons reveal that the structure of our economy is such that SMEs are not part of the major supply chains. When we talk about SMEs, I think we kind of, this is a catch-all for quite a diverse set of organizations, as it were. There's a survivalist, and often, you know, when we come here, we focus on the survivalist as SMEs, but in fact, they are very sophisticated manufacturing SMEs who are likely to be the ones who are going to benefit mostly from this thing. So I think it's important that we unpack this notion of SMEs, because they require different forms of support. So we need to differentiate the support that we offer SMEs, particularly those that are going to take advantage of the opportunities that are going to arise from here. I think that's as much as I can say. I think Minister covered all the questions.
Well, perhaps I think the one question was around conditionalities and, you know, what is the quid pro quo for government support. I think that was raised by Mr. Murray. And I think you know, one of the things that's said in the IPAP is that there will be an ongoing review and strengthening of those conditionalities to make sure that we get the maximum kind of bang for you know, public buck in terms of what, you know, that this is not just money that's supplied to supplement profitability of companies with no attached conditions, but they, you know, that increasingly the conditionalities will be in relation to things like labour intensity, market behaviour, localisation, etc. So it's one of the actions that's built into the IPAP.
Members, I think that what has happened is some of the earlier points, there have been additions to it by both the Minister, the DG, and Mr. Zalk. And I certainly don't want to cut short the discussion comment on this important thing, but on the other hand, as I said before, we expect to have further engagements on the matter, including public hearings. And again, a collaborative effort between a number of portfolio committees in Parliament, and in fact within our sister half, the NCOP as well, joining up from time to time. We're still trying to get a deeper understanding of this policy action plan. But one thing I think has become clear to us: this has been described as a very ambitious plan, but I think whenever society has been challenged, whether it be on a medical front, an economic front, industrial front, political front, then the leadership has certainly had to develop what may be described as daunting responses. And yet it is what somebody else has said within this committee: perhaps all it really takes is political will. We have a serious challenge, a series of serious challenges facing us. And This is certainly not the time for the faint-hearted. Yes, it is ambitious. But in fact, I am reassured by what I have heard and what I have read, and what the minister himself has said repeatedly, that there will be, this is a rolling action plan, and that implies a strategic review annually to check out its progress and where indeed it may need to be, if you like, reconfigured in aspects. But it is an action plan, a series of actions and a plan directly linking policy. So will it have a chance to work? I think that the commitment that we see from not simply DTI, but from all the different divisions within government and indeed the different departments, that there is a commitment. What remains for us in Parliament is to develop the same collaborative commitment. I do not believe we can exercise our oversight purely as the portfolio committee of DTI. So without going into the detail as to how we will best do this, we have already engaged with other chairpersons who've indicated we do need to work more closely together and with the respective whips. But also this offers all parties the opportunity to work together. We may share different approaches, but I do believe the objective is to turn around the economy. So I'm certainly appealing to all of us here to work together as best we can to make this a reality. We certainly would like to thank the Minister and your team, the DG and the rest of that team, for coming here at relatively short notice and outlining the policy action plan, but also sharing with us your own understanding of it and explaining a lot of the instruments that you will be utilising. So thank you again, and we look forward to engaging with you regularly on the matter. So thank you very much, Minister, and your team. For us, I think, is to look at the rest of the program. As you'll see, this program was really on two fronts. The one was certainly the major part dedicated to what we now prefer to call EPUP rather than IPUP, but that again is our own South African interpretation. I want to just hand over to the committee secretary, Mr. André Hermans, just to add to the administration and just outline where it is we're going on our program for tomorrow.
In terms of tomorrow's program, we're having an input from the implementing agency.
When do we finalize the program of the committee beyond that which was finalized at the last meeting?
You may have left a little early or perhaps just been otherwise engaged, but the program, we haven't managed to pass our own committee report, and that depended largely on yourselves having read it, and if you have read it, that'll be a very quick exercise tomorrow. The only political party that handed in any recommendations to the committee secretary, parties, was in fact the DA and the ANC. So we haven't had any other inputs on the recommendations. So any further recommendations would have to come in when we finalised and adopted the report. Is that correct? So the other thing, of course, are the minutes. Some of the minutes were, we asked the committee secretary to review them again, and they will be here tomorrow morning, as we will be doing minutes every Wednesday. The gambling legislation, I never thought I'd develop such a disinterest in a piece of legislation, but quite honestly, my interest was revived by, I understand, the recollections from the party that went this morning to members from this committee, from the DA and the ANC, with the committee secretary, who I'm sure will be able to share their views with us. But we do want to finalise this, to hand over to the House, and also to share with the Minister and the Department. And to remind you, the Minister has already indicated that they are in fact also undertaking a study, which in due course they will share with us. But tomorrow is certainly the Financial Intelligence Centre, the minutes, and the finalisation, I hope, to some degree, on the gambling legislation. So please refresh your memories on that. Is that all right? Friday's agenda will be changing somewhat, and that's largely because our sister committee, Economic Development, we were awaiting a definitive response from the Minister's office, and it was communicated to us today that he is otherwise engaged on another priority that he'd already agreed to, and we do believe that it would be constructive for us to have both ministers, both departments, the Department of Trade and Industry and Economic Development at the same time. So that was indeed Friday's agenda. However, as we have all diarised Friday to be here, we do not want to allow any fruitless waste of time, of committee time, so I wanted to suggest to the committee secretary that we utilise 2 hours of Friday to three in getting rid of all the outstanding work. The committee report, which is ready for the archives, let alone the House. Secondly, after the committee report, the absolute finalisation on gambling, and we move forward from that point with a clear slate the following week. So that would require people to be here at 8:30 to 10:30. But they were going to be here till 12:30. You were going to be here till that time. Yes, thank you.
Chairperson, can I just ask that the committee secretary do a bit of homework and hear whether it's possible to move that session to Thursday afternoon?
Right, I'm sure that the committee secretary will check with programming on that front, and if that's possible with all of the members sitting here, then indeed we may be able to consider that. Is there anyone that it wouldn't suit Thursday afternoon? Would suit everyone, so please clear it with the Chief Whip and the programming officers and so on. Thank you very much. So, Minister, unless you have anything to share with us, we're going to adjourn this meeting until tomorrow. But thank you once again.